Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to New Books in Biography. I'm Oline Eaton. The story behind John Kennedy Toole's A Confederacy of Dunces is one of the most interesting in American literary history. Despite Toole's repeated efforts to gain the attention of publishers, the novel that made him famous wasn't published until 12 years after his death. Today I'm talking with Corey McLaughlin about his new book entitled Butterfly and the Typewriter, The Short Tragic Life of John Kennedy Toole and the Remarkable Story of a Confederacy of Dunces. Hi, Corey. Thank you so much for joining us for New Books in Biography. I wonder if you could just kick things off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm a graduate of University of Virginia, and I teach English at Germanna Community College in Fredericksburg, Virginia. And I'm a first-time biographer with a biography of John Kennedy Toole. Worked on the book for a little over 6 years, I guess. And I guess that's my initial biography.
Okay. So what drew you to the story of the subject of John Kennedy Toole and A Confederate Dunces? Because it really is about both of them in conjunction.
Right.
With yeah.
Well, I've always loved to go down to New Orleans, but after Hurricane Katrina, I started going down frequently to volunteer. And then I decided to teach a college course on New Orleans culture and history, and of course put Confederacy of Dunces on the syllabus, and decided, you know, I had to do some more digging about the author. And it became clear at that point, once I started preparing for the course, that there really wasn't a quality biography on the author, and it was such an interesting story, unique story of publishing. And there was one memoir that I read. The title was Ken and Thelma, and it was by Joel Fletcher, and he was friends with John Kennedy Toole. And in that fairly short book, a beautifully written book, he said that there really was no proper biography, and he was hoping for a biographer to come along. And I flipped over the back cover and saw that he lived really only about an hour away from me, and so in Virginia, and he returned my calls, and we began an email discussion, and that's how it kind of all started from that point.
Wow. Did you find any other sources particularly helpful?
Well, sure. The main source is the Toole Papers at Tulane University, and this is a collection of essentially a little archive on Toole's life and his mother's life, things that she had kept and then ended up at Tulane. So that was the really, in terms of primary documents and things like that, those are the main sources that I used. The only problem with those is that his mother was very selective in what she kept and what she did not keep, and so you're really looking at a version of her son that she wanted you to see. And so to flesh the story out, to make him a more complex individual, I really just, for each period in his life, I found people that fortunately were still alive and remembered him. And that's how I got some of the anecdotes that I put in the book that I think give some detail into the character he was and then how his personality developed.
And the novel is very much a novel of New Orleans. Can you give us kind of, I know this is asking you a lot, but can you give us a little crash course in New Orleans for those listening who've never been, just kind of how it played out in his work and how important it was to him?
Oh, sure. Well, one of the first, I think, really important things for people to understand about New Orleans who have never been is that the city is really a city of small, tight-knit neighborhoods that kind of merge and coalesce in ways that a visitor could never tell where the borders are, really. And for people who, you know, may have even been once or twice, they probably have images of Bourbon Street and the French Quarter and those tourist centers. But for someone who grows up in New Orleans, they really understand their city as a kind of patchwork of these neighborhoods. And these neighborhoods have their own kind of unique personalities, sometimes even different accents. You can hear one accent in the downtown area, but you go uptown and the people will speak in a completely different way. And, you know, this was crucial for Toole because he was an observer above everything else. And he realized this at a very young age, this kind of unique patchwork of personalities that that colored his city, and they were all living together and distinctly, you know, individual, but at the same time merging and clashing in all kinds of hilarious and intense ways at times. And of course, the culmination of this is Carnival or Mardi Gras, and that as a kind of metaphor is important. Because that's a time where all these different, they're crews. I mean, they're different clubs, but they're from different areas of the city. They come together. They work very hard together. They put together floats, and then they march through their city, crossing these barriers. And that mentality is deeply embedded into the psyche of New Orleans, New Orleanians, and certainly Toole. And so, what we have in his novel is something that reflects that model. You have a collection of eccentric, unique, bizarre characters that are moving about the city, and they're all kind of, you know, they all have their own goals. The main one is Ignatius Riley. I guess the main drama that propels the novel is that he has to find a job. And of course, this is a horrible thing for an academic to have to do, like Ignatius Riley is. But this is a cover-up for his desires to do this kind of social revolution. And it's brought into absurd clashes with every area of the city, the very wealthy, and all the way to the poor black individual who is wants to keep a job, so he's not locked up as the policeman has told him he has to do, but he ends up, you know, sort of being the hero in the end. Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult story to explain. One of the things it is, it's a picaresque. So it's a novel of episodes. And so it kind of just goes from episode to episode, and you're supposed to enjoy it in the moment. The dialogue between the characters is absolutely hilarious. And so the plot is really secondary to the characters and the way they interact with each other.
Mm-hmm. So can we backtrack a little bit? If you could talk about Toole's childhood in New Orleans a bit and his relationships with his parents.
Sure. His parents were born in a neighborhood called the Faubourg Marigny, which is really in the downtown area. And when they came along, it was a real working class section of New Orleans. But his mother specifically wanted to get out. She always saw herself as someone who is refined, and her family at one time did have money. And so before they had their son, they moved to the uptown section, which was a more of a suburban atmosphere for the time, larger houses, lots of green space, and very affluent people. And I mention that because I think it's important to understand Toole had roots in very much the working class, old New Orleans, but he grew up in an atmosphere that was much more affluent. Now, that doesn't mean that his parents were affluent. In fact, they weren't. They struggled financially, but it was very important, particularly to his mother, to maintain their place in uptown. And so he was really privileged in a lot of ways. His father was a car salesman. Sometimes he would do well selling cars, and a lot of times he would not do well selling cars. His mother was a variety of things. She was an elocutionist. She also would plan pageants. And the important thing to take from that, I think, is that she was very much dedicated to the arts, particularly with theater. And so early on, she encouraged her son to participate in theater. And she was, from the moment he was born, convinced that he was meant for greatness. And so, you know, he grew up with a great deal of pressure on one hand to meet this expectation. On the other hand, he was very talented. He was very talented at performing and mimicry, and certainly in school throughout his schooling. You know, he skipped two grades in elementary school. Schooling kind of came easy to him. He didn't think it was any fantastic feat to make straight A's.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that at Tulane he began to express a resentment toward modern America, and in particular the notion of the, quote, learned pauper, which really plays out in his own life as he kind of creates this balance, or doesn't balance it, but tries to do it, of being a hybrid of scholar, writer, and teacher, which happens in Tulane and then in Columbia as well. Can you discuss a bit about the learned pauper?
Sure. I mean, you know, on one hand, he had a great deal of opportunities, but his mother certainly would never let him forget that money was a struggle. And the ways in which he encountered money at Tulane really struck a chord with him. I mean, he wasn't just with, you know, the high school boys, the local high school boys. He was now with sons and daughters that had been sent to Tulane, and they had lots of expendable money. And so witnessing this affluence on a kind of peer-to-peer level, I think frustrated him. But on the other hand, I mean, he was also noticing that they weren't the brightest individuals. And so here he was, a very smart man, young man, and yet he was having to figure out how to, he had a scholarship, so he didn't have to figure out necessarily how to pay for tuition, but he had to do things like sell hot dogs at the football games. And one summer he sold hot tamales in a cart, and these kinds of jobs that, you know, might be not worthy of someone of scholarly station, if you will. And so I think this bothered him, and certainly he latched onto it when he's developing his main character, who of course is a medieval scholar and very intelligent and witty, but simply cannot really hold down a job. He considers it part of the modern world that is just unjust to make someone who's so talented intellectually to actually make them work for a living. So I think he understood the humor of it, but certainly in his college papers he expresses a real frustration of society and a kind of upper echelon of society that didn't have to be educated or intellectual in any ways. If they could, just make money off the money that their parents had already made, then that was just fine. You know, and that this was a kind of absurdity of modern life.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that absurdity was enhanced for him when he got to Columbia and was teaching a hunter and running across town while trying to get his master's, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think he saw this at every stage in his life. And I don't think he maintained a deep resentment. I don't think he had a chip on his shoulder about it. But certainly, you know, it wasn't until really the end of his life that he was actually making some pretty good money. And his parents were always, you know, for much of his adult life, they were financially dependent on him. So the pressure of money was a very real pressure for him.
Somewhat unrelated, but I was absolutely fascinated by the detail that he essentially recycled pieces of his bachelor's thesis for his master's thesis.
I mean, you're being kind, actually.
I was trying to be as kind as possible.
I read both of them, and it's pretty much word for word the same paper. There are some minor changes, and his advisor at Columbia made some suggestions that he accepted. But it does go back to money. I mean, it's not completely unrelated. He got a Woodrow Wilson scholarship to Columbia for his master's degree. But the master's degree was usually completed in actually three semesters. But the scholarship was only good for two semesters. And there was no way that his family could afford, you know, him staying in New York even for a summer to finish things up. So he had to figure out a way to finish. And so I think, could he have written another thesis? Of course he could have. I don't doubt that. I think it was a matter of time. He had the paper. It's not as if Tulane, you know, sent their copy to Columbia, and so he submitted it, probably thinking, you know, who would ever know. It does offer some credit to the degree of his undergraduate work as well. So his undergraduate thesis at Tulane, which was accepted, an honors thesis, was satisfactory for highest honors at Columbia. So I think that offers some testimony to the quality of the thesis and the work.
Mm-hmm. So after Columbia, he wound up teaching, actually I think he didn't graduate with a PhD, but he went to Southwestern Louisiana Institute.
Right. It is a little tricky. So just for listeners to get the chronology, he graduates from Tulane with his undergraduate. Then he gets the Woodrow Wilson Scholarship, goes off to Columbia, gets his master's in 1 year, graduates in the spring of 1959. Then he wants to continue on with his PhD, but he doesn't have money to do it. And he can't get a teaching job with no teaching experience. So he's got to go get teaching experience somewhere. And so he goes to Southwestern Louisiana Institute, which was in Lafayette, Louisiana. It is now the University of Louisiana, Lafayette. And he's there for 1 year and really gets some teaching credentials. Of course, while he's there, I mean, this is an incredibly seminal year for him, and I don't think he ever expected it to be. I think he initially came to Lafayette believing that, you know, he'd teach for a year, he'd get some experience, he'd be back in New York, he'd be able to pursue his PhD and teach at probably Hunter College. You know, what he found was really some delightful friends. He developed a very close relationship with a professor, and several professors, really. But one, which is most important to people who know Confederacy of Dunces, is he met Bobby Byrne, who was a sort of rotund medieval scholar, and even though they were teaching remedial English, he would make everyone read Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, a kind of obscure text. And he had absurd ways of dressing, mismatched. He had a deerstalker trucker hat, and a mustache, and this is really he was the model for Ignatius Reilly. And so he had really a full year of just observing Bobby Byrne and kind of absorbing all of his different personality traits, and that certainly played out in his novel. He also had developed a friendship with a woman or a family, the Rickles family. Patricia Rickles was the wife and mother of the family, and she was a professor and actually died in 2009. I was fortunate enough to meet with her and speak with her several times. But she absolutely loved him. They never had a romantic relationship, although it's pretty clear that he would have liked to have had a really romantic relationship with her. But she was married and very much in love with her husband, and they had a little boy, and he really enjoyed you know, just hanging out with little Gordon. In fact, before he left Lafayette, he gave their young son all of his childhood books as a gift. So Lafayette was a really important important time for him, but he wasn't going to do anything great in Lafayette, and of course that's what he had to do since he was a young boy. I mean, he had to do something fantastic, something great with his life. Mm-hmm. And at this point he thought the track was going to be, you know, get a PhD and become a professor and get tenure and write books and things like that. But there is this other side of him that I haven't mentioned yet. In his first year at Columbia, he's also experiencing some a kind of dissonance with the scholarly pursuit. I mean, it always risks becoming too dry, too analytical, you know, absorbing all the life out of literature and just sort of dry analysis. And so he does write some poems that suggest he's questioning whether he's going to, whether he really wants to be a professor, or he wants to be in more creative pursuits, I guess, a fiction writer or a poet.
It's ironic then that he winds up in the army, and that's where what breathes life back into his work.
Yeah, and sort of a turn of unexpected irony. He so he goes back to New York, and he's there for a year, and now he doesn't have a scholarship. So he's got to financially make this work, and so he gets a job at Hunter College. So Columbia is on the west side of Manhattan, and Hunter College is on the east side of Manhattan. And, you know, in between that is Central Park. And so you can imagine every day, you know, he was taking classes in the morning, then racing on the subway over to the east side to teach in the evening. And this is, you know, this back and forth really started to wear on him. And he couldn't take a full load of graduate courses because he couldn't afford the tuition. And so in his second semester when he was there, he actually moved closer to Hunter College, and he ended up signing up for only one course at Columbia, and that meant he was a potential draft. He couldn't avoid the draft anymore, and so that's how he landed in the Army, particularly at the time there was the Berlin crisis going on. Vietnam was just getting started, so it's not as if he was drafted and was going to be sent to Vietnam. That wasn't a risk. But he gets a great, a very fortunate position teaching English in Puerto Rico. And while he's there, you know, he meets more unique characters. In his first year, essentially secures the position of a kind of manager of all the instructors. And this means that he gets his own office. And so after a full year of living in barracks, he goes into his own office space, and it kind of just all comes out. I mean, it just really came pouring out of him in a couple months.
I was really intrigued by to see the impact of current events upon his writing, because I know he was preoccupied with Marilyn Monroe, who died while he was in Puerto Rico, and then he was writing at a good clip and then stopped upon the assassination of President Kennedy. How did that affect his writing?
Right. Well, he was riding along really well in Puerto Rico, and in fact was so convinced that the book would be published. He almost in an unprecedented way in terms of his life. I mean, he always had some reservations about his writing, whether it was good enough, particularly his creative writing. And he starts writing home and says, I've got this project, and the novel's coming along, and I have no doubt that it'll be published. It just needs some editing. And then he makes a decision to come home. He's not going to go back to Columbia, and he's very clear with his parents. He said, as if there was some discussion on what he's going to do with his academic pursuits, he said, I'm not starting a PhD program. I'm not going to Tulane. I'm not going to law school. I am going to teach English, and I'm going to edit the book. And so that's his plan when he returns to New Orleans. And he was, as you mentioned, he was devastated by the death of Marilyn Monroe. He had a deep fascination with her. And then shortly after he returned, JFK was assassinated. And there's several reasons why I think he identified with JFK. For one, he was Catholic, and certainly they share the name John N. and Kennedy. Although there was no relationship between them. He was named in 1937, and his mother had no idea of JFK at that point. I think he identified with him in a lot of ways, as many people did, but kind of on a personal level. And then Lee Harvey Oswald was in New Orleans, just a few miles down the street from where he lived right before he went to Dallas. I mean, Lee Harvey Oswald was a New Orleanian, and this tragedy struck him very hard. And he writes and says nothing was funny to him anymore, and he just could not do anything else with the novel. And so he sealed it up and sent it off to a New York publisher.
Which Simon and Schuster, right? And he had an extraordinary correspondence, really, with an editor there.
Yeah, anyone who's trying to get published or has been published, in the last 20, 30, 40 years, I guess, would sort of read the way in which Toole carried out his publishing pursuit and just be amazed how far he got. Now, this was during the time, this was in the early 60s, so literary agents weren't the standard yet. There were plenty of agents, but it was possible to send your manuscript even to a top publisher and potentially get a response from them. But Toole was fairly smart in how he went about. I mean, he was an academic, he was a scholar, so he researched who he wanted to see this manuscript, and he selected Robert Gottlieb. Robert Gottlieb was really a rising star in New York publishing at the time. Now he's a legend in terms of publishing. But at that time, he had worked for several years with Joseph Heller, and Catch 22 had been released under his watch, and Toole loved Catch 22. There was also another novel that was released in the early 60s titled Stern, and it was by Bruce J. Friedman, who's another wonderfully funny American writer. It hasn't quite got the stature that Joseph Heller has achieved, I guess, but Toole loved both of these novels and said, any editor that brought those works to publication will like this. And he was right on. I mean, he had never spoken to Gottlieb or anything. He just he sent the manuscript. It landed on the desk of Gottlieb's assistant. Her name was Ann Jolette. And Ann Jolette was from the South, and I believe she had been to New Orleans. I'm not certain on that, but she first read it, and then she brought it to Gottlieb and said, you know, you have to take a look at this seriously. And Gottlieb thought it was wonderfully funny, and they actually have a two-year exchange of letters where they're talking about changes and edits. Now, what's remarkable about that is that, you know, in today's publishing, I mean, you're lucky if you get a paragraph from an editor back. I mean, let alone an agent. I mean, it's just so difficult to get that much response. And so, without an agent, he sent it to New York, and he begins a two-year correspondence with one of the greatest editors New York publishing has ever seen. Mm-hmm.
And it was during this time that his mental illness surfaced as well, right?
Yes, it's a very complex question in terms of his how it began, how it started. I do want to preface by saying that his family had on both sides had a history of some mental illness. His father, had developed a kind of slow trudge towards senility, and by the 60s was pretty much relegated to the back room. So that's on one hand, it seems that he probably had some genetic disposition for some kind of mental illness. Mm-hmm. He also became intensely connected with the book in a way that, as one of his friends at the time said, it was almost remarkable the degree to which he became more and more. He defined himself by the book, even though it was just under review at a publisher. He had this deep sense of it needing to be recognized and understood by the world. And so the pursuit of editing, which is not an unreasonable pursuit when you're trying to publish something, I think the pursuit of editing was rendered nearly impossible. He was so attached to it. He had a very difficult time changing it in any way. And so I think that is an indicator of some disturbance as he sort of descended and wrapped himself in the novel. And then some friends also noticed that he was clearly going through some delusional episodes, some clear paranoia, and really this started in 1967. It becomes very clear, and by 1968 he's seeing a doctor for some very painful headaches, and has some pretty alarming behavior. Never threatening anyone, but maybe hallucinating, believing people are chasing after him, things like that.
Mm-hmm. I know that somehow in popular culture he's often been cast as an alcoholic, gay, and closeted, which really wasn't the case at all, and I'm not quite sure where did that come from, and you really do a lot to debunk that in your book.
Yeah, some people have in some of the reviews and responses I've heard, I guess my aim in debunking it was not to prove that he was straight and never touched alcohol or anything like that. My questioning, some of this was, well, how do we know that he was an alcoholic? How do we know that he was homosexual? Where this comes from, as far as I could see or tell, one of the earliest episodes was actually from Hollywood's response to the book. There was a great deal of interest in not only Confederacy of Dunces, But as the film rights were sold, there were some producers at the time positioning to maybe do a biopic of Tool. And excuse me, Joel Fletcher, the friend who wrote the memoir that I mentioned at the beginning of our interview, he met with a producer on two occasions, and that producer seemed to be just dead set on getting Joel to admit that Ken was gay and that he was, you know, hanging out in dark, seedy bars in the French Quarter. And so that was the earliest point that I, so this would be in the 80s. And I mean, you can imagine from a producer, a movie maker in the 80s, that would certainly be sensational. And in a lot of ways, it'd be an easy answer, you know, for why he ended things the way he did, you know, a repressed homosexuality that he couldn't resolve, and so he destroyed himself. And then this all became real solidified in the first biography. It was titled Ignatius Rising. And the authors of that book, as they admit in their introduction, they wanted to write a book on the making of the film Confederacy of Dunces, but when that fell through, they decided to write a biography. And they take some pretty grand steps to analyze him as a closeted homosexual and an alcoholic. So, in my pursuit, I mean, I was asking, where do we know? I mean, are there any indicators anywhere of either of these behaviors? And the resounding answer is no. I mean, I found no stories where he was coming into class drunk or disheveled or anything to indicate that his he was being influenced by excessive amounts of alcohol. He drank, he certainly did, there's no doubt about that. But, I mean, he certainly got drunk, I have no doubt. But there's no indication of it being an addiction. And the question of sexuality, you know, I don't know if he was gay. I don't know if he was straight. He really kept his relationships to himself. I mean, I can tell you that he had some intense feelings towards Patricia Rickles. Reportedly, he had been in, or he had wanted to propose to a high school sweetheart of his, but for some reason that didn't work out. Did he experiment? Maybe. But there's nothing to indicate. There was no love letter. There was no, even, I mean, I didn't even hear any credible anecdotes of experimenting. And you know, I should mention, too, that many of his friends that I was interviewing are gay, which is certainly not unusual in New Orleans by any means. But even they came back and said, look, you know, I think I'd be sensitive to this. I mean, I think I would know. And they came back resoundingly and said, there's nothing to indicate that he was gay, at least the Tool that I knew. But, you know, I'd also ask, and I mentioned this in the book, I mean, what does it matter? I mean, it only matters if you want to somehow analyze his novel through the lens of repressed homosexuality. And if you want to do that, or even just, you know, even just homosexuality, not even repressed, if you want to do that, then you need some grounds to do it. And, you know, I just think that that's unfair. I think it's unfair to use that as a tool to, or a lens to analyze his novel, but sort of overlook the fact that there isn't anything in his life to indicate that he was, and he certainly isn't here to clarify his sexual preferences.
Right.
So that was my aim, was to say, you know, we really don't know. It doesn't matter to me if he was or he wasn't, and it's not fair to suggest that he was, since we don't know. I mean, it's just wrong in my
in my estimation.
No, it was really interesting to read as a fellow biographer, because I think a lot of biographers would take the easy way out and say, oh yeah, he definitely was, even if there wasn't, I mean, if there was some sort of anecdote that might kind of imply it in a shady way, but not explicitly. So it was really interesting to read how you handled the situation. I thought you did a really excellent job.
Thank you. Well, you know, I should mention that near the beginning of writing this book, we also I met with a documentary filmmaker named Joe Sanford, and he was doing a documentary on Tool. And in fact, he brought me on as a producer. Our conversations ran weekly for hours, and we were really working hard to decipher, you know, with a real sense of the responsibility of what it means to tell someone's life story, especially if they're not alive. You know, what kind of responsibility you're taking on, and you can't be overly sympathetic to every single moment of their lives. You know, I mean, you have to be critical, but at the same time, you know, you have to be sensitive to what you can really say. I mean, look, if he was an alcoholic and a closeted homosexual, it would be an easy answer. Mm-hmm. And it's sensational, I guess. But I do think, in a lot of ways, particularly the question of sexuality, speaks to what maybe as a society at this point we're looking for, more so than really what's there, at least what evidence is there. I have seen it time and time again when I've done talks and this issue comes up, a kind of indignation at my argument that somehow I'm stealing Tool away from a group that had owned him somehow. You know, he was, or maybe in some ways he is theirs. You know, another example of how you know, a homophobic society destroys people. And I'm not saying that that didn't happen, but I think you have to be clear-eyed in saying, well, what's driving you to say this about this person who's not here anymore? If it is driven by evidence, even anecdotal evidence that can be, you know, verified, then that's one thing. But if it's really driven by a desire to, you know, explain a tragic end with a value that maybe we're trying to negotiate here, then that's not fair. You know, I'm not a politician, I'm a biographer. So I come at it from a different angle. So.
Well, thank you so much. This has been really excellent, and it should be an indication to readers we've only discussed the first half of the book. We didn't even hit upon Thelma and publication and Walker Percy, so they obviously need to read it because there's so much more interesting stuff in there. But thank you so much for talking with us today about Butterfly and the Typewriter. Any idea what you'll be writing next?
You know, I've got a few projects. I've been doing some research on the writer James Purdy, and an article appeared in Vice magazine. And so he has my interest at the moment. But I tell you, I've also been captivated by another friend of Tool's, New Orleans artist named Angela Gregory, who lived a very fascinating and long life, and has yet to really have her full story told. So some things are up in the air, I guess.
I've been talking today with Corey McLaughlin about Butterfly and the Typewriter, the short tragic life of John Kennedy Toole, and the remarkable story of A Confederacy of Dunces, which is now out in hardback. I'm Oline Eaton. This is New Books in Biography. Thanks for listening.